CT-05-007 in the matter of the complaint filed by Prairie Wave Telecommunications, Inc. against AT&T Communications of the Midwest, Inc. regarding access charges. And the question today is, shall the commission grant Prairie Wave's motion to dismiss AT&T's counterclaim? And shall the commission grant in whole or in part Prairie Wave's motion for summary judgment on its complaints? Or on its complaint, singular. And not having anything to do with singular. Singular with an S. we're taking a record on this one. So if everyone please remember, we do have a court reporter here. And if you're on the phone line, please speak clearly and slowly. With that, good afternoon, Mr. Heaston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Heaston. I'm in-house counsel for Prairie Wave Communications. I think I got a year older today waiting for this to happen. But last year in 05, or even before that in 04, Prairie Wave filed a cost study for Prairie Wave Telecommunications, Inc., which is its competitive local exchange company in South Dakota. Filed that cost study pursuant to the commission's rules, which were promulgated back in 1993 when Commissioner Johnson was probably still in high school. And these rules have been in effect and have been operational and have been applied by the state, applied by the staff, applied by the commissioners throughout in a consistent, uniform manner. There has been nothing to cause any change to those rules. There have been numerous dockets today that involve those rules and the application of those rules. I even saw one where we went back and reopened a docket for an 11-cent rate and approved that without refund, and that was fine. We took a look at a 2005 test year and said, let's preserve that test year for these companies because they're continuing to invest and they want to be able to preserve that. Now, Prairie Wave Telecommunications did not have to file a cost study. Prior to becoming Prairie Wave, when it was part of McLeod, it did not. It just mirrored the Quest rate. And the Quest rate, based upon a 2001 docket, was over 6 cents a minute, 0.060905. And why do I know that? Because I was representing U.S. West when we went through that whole long ordeal to get that rate established. And it went to court a couple of times, and we ended up with an agreement to phase in a rate up to that 060905. And I know Harlan Best and Greg Rizloff remember that because they were part of that. They know these costs. They know the cost studies. They know the rules, and they know how to apply them. They know how to review those rules when a company like Prairie Wave comes in and files its costs. So that when they're done with their review and they come to you as a commission and say that these rates are fair and reasonable and reflect the costs of the company, that you know they've done a thorough job and that's what those rates are and what they should be, that those rates are fair and reasonable. And under South Dakota statute, when you approved Prairie Wave Telecommunications rates in December of 2004, those were fair and reasonable rates. Now, through that entire process, AT&T has been around. AT&T participated in that rulemaking back in 93. They know all about this. They could have intervened in any one of these dockets. They could have intervened in the Prairie Wave Telecommunications docket. They didn't. Those rates were set. The three-year rule has been discussed here, that you have a rule that says that we have to come in at least every 3 years and file a cost study to make sure that our rates are fair and reasonable. That gives you a review. That does a couple of things. It gives us rate stability, but it gives the customer rate stability. The customer knows what the rate's going to be. It isn't constantly changing. And if it is going to change, it isn't going to change without the review of the experts on your staff with your review and your order. Now, the statutes take care of this. All of this can be lumped under one one term, really, the filed rate doctrine. That's why it's, that's why you have this. That's why you have these rules. That's why you have statutes like 4931.18, 4931.19, and the whole series in 4931.12. That is the fail filed rate doctrine. We have to come to you, the commission, file our tariffs for access rates. You have to review them. You have to approve them. And that's what happened in December of 2004. Those rates went into effect at the end of December of 2004. AT&T paid those rates until May of 2005, then stopped paying completely. Didn't pay us a dime at telecommunications. And hasn't paid us a dime since. Now, if you read the, if you've read my briefs, if you understand the filed rate doctrine at all, if you've looked at even the FCC order I cited to you in our, my initial motion for summary judgment, you know that refusal to pay a rate that is presumed fair and reasonable and therefore lawful is not lawful. You can't do that. A company cannot decide it isn't going to pay. It has to pay the rate. That rate is presumed to be the lawful rate under that doctrine, and they have not paid us a dime toward those rates. And that's wrong. It's unlawful. So when we filed the complaint in November of 2005 and they filed their response in December of 2005, they filed a counterclaim saying, oh, no, the rate's not fair. It's not reasonable. Well, why isn't it fair, not fair, or not reasonable? Well, it's different than U.S. West rate, or Quest rate. It's different than the Quest rate. That's the only factual allegation in the whole pleading. The only one. They can't tell you why. They say, well, it's unfair and unreasonable. But they can't tell you why. They don't say the staff screwed up and didn't review our rates and that they mistook what we filed as our cost study and the rate base that we used, the rate year of 2003, that was wrong. They didn't say that you screwed up by listening to your staff. So that rate is fair. That we should be paid. Now, you did do the rate, the rulemaking in 1993, and you put a three-year rule in there, again, to give stability to not only the company but to the customer. So you know what the fair and reasonable rate is, and you know what you need to pay. Now, I'm not saying AT&T can't file a complaint against a rate, but they've got to allege more than it's just different than somebody else's rate. As a matter of fact, our rate, which is under 7 cents, is closer to the Quest rate than it is to anybody else's rate in the state by a big margin. And so if there's anything that's any hint that it would be unreasonable, it's not there. It's not there. And so that's why we believe this is a legitimate motion for summary judgment. We're due to come back in next year under the three-year rule with a 2006 study year, refile that cost study. And that's what we plan to do. We could come in and mirror Quest. Quest hasn't filed a cost study in over 6 years. It didn't file one last time. It just wanted to write on the rates it was with. And as I remember the filing, the one reason was is because their new cost study actually showed a higher rate than they were charging now, and they didn't want to do that. So we believe this is should be a judgment in our favor, a summary judgment. There are no disputed facts. The law is the filed rate doctrine. They are supposed to pay that rate. There's no reason to go to any kind of hearing here because you have a three-year rule, and they had an opportunity to operate by that, and they have alleged absolutely nothing that would indicate that that rate is not fair and not reasonable as you ordered in December of 2004. So we would ask the commission to dismiss AT&T's counterclaim and to give us a summary judgment on our complaint and order AT&T to pay us. We're right now, we're out almost $170,000. We're not the size of AT&T, and $170,000 is a lot of money to us. And we need to have that money paid by AT&T. Every other carrier like them, and there are 51 of them that could be one plus picked in our switch, pay the rate, but AT&T. that. I'm open for questions, sir.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Johnson, did you want to ask a question now? Or?
No, I would just wanted to make a quick comment. I appreciate Mr. Heaston's historical perspective, but for those of us that are a little bit younger, and I'm particularly interested in your comments because I know you were able to study with the great Mr. Alexander Graham Bell, so do appreciate your comments.
AT&T.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, and you have your local counsel here at the mic as well, and Pierre, and I'll just ask you, we do have a court reporter here. If both of you just make appearances, we'd appreciate that. Thank you.
This is Bill Van Camp. I'm in-state counsel for AT&T, and Rebecca DeCook of Holland & Hart will be making the presentation, but we both will be available for questions of the commission.
Thank you very much. Ms. Cook?
It's DeCook, DeCook.
Thank you.
Thank you. And good afternoon, Chairman Saar, Commissioners. I know by having listened some of the morning that you'll let me know if you can't hear me, and I appreciate you letting me appear by phone. I'd like to frame the issues here a little more carefully. I think the issues have been a bit blurred by Prairie Wave. There are two motions before the Commission for consideration today. The first is a motion for summary judgment on Prairie Wave's complaint, and the second is a motion to dismiss AT&T's counterclaim. And they each present very separate matters for consideration by the Commission, and so we need to look at them separately and determine what the standard of review is and whether that standard of review has been met by Prairie Wave in this case. Based upon the law AT&T cited in its brief and the law cited by staff in its brief, motions to dismiss in civil actions are generally disfavored and are rarely granted. A motion to dismiss can only be granted if it appears beyond a doubt that the complainant can prove no set of facts in support of his claim, which would entitle him to relief. Thus, a motion to dismiss tests the law of a plaintiff's claim, not the facts which support it. And it's the facts that Prairie Wave has really focused on in this case, not the law. Though, therefore, it's kind of turned the standard for a motion to dismiss on its head. In addition, the Fenske case that's cited by staff states that the material allegations of a complaint must be accepted as true, as well as any inferences reasonably drawn from those facts. Those allegations must be viewed in the light most favorable to the pleader, and in order to determine whether the allegations state a claim on any possible theory, that is, legal theory. So, again, it's a test of the law, not the facts that are alleged in a complaint. And this is consistent with South Dakota law, which requires nothing more than notice pleading when you file a complaint or a counterclaim, and that's SDCL 15-68. A. Now, Prairie Wave acknowledges all these legal predicates, but in its reply and in its argument here today, it ignores them and instead focuses entirely on the facts pled by AT&T, not the law. Prairie Wave appears to contend that AT&T has not pled enough facts or the right facts to support its claim, but that's really not the issue. The issue is there a set of facts that could be presented to the trier of fact, in this case you, the commission, that would support a claim for relief under South Dakota law. And AT&T's complaint surely satisfies this requirement. AT&T's counterclaim charges that Prairie Wave's rates are unjust, unreasonable, discriminatory, and undermine competition. The counterclaim asserts that there is a difference between Quest and Prairie Wave's intrastate switched access rates, and that difference is unjustified. South Dakota law is pretty clear that AT&T doesn't have to prove its case in its complaint, as Prairie Wave suggests it must do. The pleader merely has to assert sufficient facts that, if proven, would state a cognizable legal claim. AT&T has done so. South Dakota law 49-31-11 prohibits unjust and unreasonable discrimination in the rates or prices charged for telecommunications services. South Dakota Law 4931.1.4 obligates the Commission to establish fair and reasonable prices. AT&T has called into question whether Prairie Wave's rates satisfy these statutes. So it's met the requirements that would withstand a motion to dismiss. It has established a claim for relief under these statutes. In its initial filing, Prairie Wave asserts that it's that Rule 2010-2707 and the Commission's prior review of its rates shield its access rates from any challenge for 3 years, and therefore AT&T cannot state a legal claim for relief. It also seems to suggest in its argument today that the filed rate doctrine, as a result, would protect its rates from any challenge and would require payment in irrespective of a challenge. There is nothing in South Dakota law or the Commission rules that insulate Prairie Wave switch access rates from review by complaint or a Commission-initiated investigation at any time. And our brief cites to the various provisions of South Dakota law, which provides for complaints and which gives the Commission ample statutory authority to conduct the review that's requested in AT&T's counterclaim. In its reply, Prairie Wave seems to admit that AT&T has a right to file a complaint and to challenge a rate in a filed tariff. It then, however, asserts that AT&T hasn't pled the right facts or enough facts. And as I discussed before, that's simply not sufficient to satisfy the standards for a motion to dismiss. There is law that provides AT&T a claim for relief. AT&T has provided sufficient notice of what its claim is with respect to that law. So Prairie Wave's motion to dismiss, in our view, should be denied. Similarly, the filed rate doctrine that was mentioned by Mr. Heaston doesn't provide any recourse here. The filed rate doctrine simply doesn't apply. The filed rate doctrine prohibits a regulated entity from charging rates other than those that are tariffed. It does not in any way prohibit the legal challenge of the existing rates. And as I discussed earlier, the Commission is vested with clear authority to review and revise switched access rates at any time. Therefore, AT&T's counterclaim is simply not barred by the filed rate doctrine. Prairie Wave also suggested that AT&T's counterclaim is barred by the doctrine of res judicata. It appears that Prairie Wave has abandoned that argument, so I won't restate our defense to that assertion. As a result, I think based on all of this, it's clear that AT&T's counterclaim is sufficiently pled and should survive any motion to dismiss based on South Dakota law, and therefore we'd urge the Commission to deny Prairie Wave's motion to dismiss. As for the motion for summary judgment, there are really two facets to the motion for Prairie Wave's complaint. The first facet appears to be the payments that were due up until the time that Prairie Wave filed its complaint. And as I indicated in the pleading I filed on behalf of AT&T, AT&T has agreed to pay those amounts. And AT&T informed Prairie Wave that it would agree to pay these amounts by email dated May 15, 2006. And we sent Prairie Wave a chart depicting the amount that AT&T had determined it owed Prairie Wave in order to obtain Prairie Wave's concurrence that we had properly calculated the amount. Prairie Wave ultimately concurred in the chart, but noted a discrepancy which AT&T then proceeded to investigate. AT&T was unable to confirm the discrepancy, but has agreed to pay and has authorized the payment, and payment should reach Prairie Wave on both the past due amounts, which are being paid in total up through the date of the counterclaim, and the undisputed portion of the bill that's, that has accrued since the filing of the counterclaim. In total, Prairie Wave should receive a payment by August 14th of approximately $130,000. And that's a rough number, but it's roughly that amount. And at this point, the amount that's in dispute is approximately $8,000. And that's through the 7-1 billing period, 7-106 billing period. As a result, we believe that Prairie Wave's complaint is moot up to the point in which AT&T filed a counterclaim. We believe that AT&T's counterclaim, however, puts at issue the validity and reasonableness of Prairie Wave's rates, and that therefore any motion to dismiss that would affect the period following the filing of the counterclaim should be denied. And I'm open to any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, and you did come through loudly and clearly, so we thank you for that. What we're going to do is we'll hear from staff, and then we'll see if commissioners have questions. But if you'd stay on the line, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
Staff.
Thank you, Chairman Saar. And just so Commissioner Johnson doesn't feel like he's the only one being picked on, I, too, was in high school in 1993. But just to keep this brief and move it along, staff would rest on its brief for its arguments and would echo AT&T's comments as to the motion to dismiss. Staff does not believe that res judicata or the filed rate doctrine prohibit AT&T from filing a counterclaim. As to the summary judgment motion, it is clear that the standard of review for summary judgment is that if there's any showing of material fact that is different, the party is not entitled to summary judgment as of a matter of law. And it is clear that we have two different stories here. We have Prairie Wave saying that no payment has been offered or tendered or received, and now we have AT&T saying that a payment is going to be coming for past rates due on August 14th. I think it would take some ferreting out of those issues and some evidence to make sure that that issue is taken care of before we summarily dismiss the past due payment issues. And with that, I guess staff would rest on its brief.
Thank you very much. Mr. Houston, why don't we give you an opportunity to respond, and then we'll see if the commissioners have questions. Thank you.
In addressing what AT&T has discussed, if you look at the Schlosser case, which is the case that AT&T relied on, Judge Keene had to go beyond the pleading to additional elements that had been introduced as a part of the pleading, and that was a contract. AT&T hasn't done anything like that. If you read the statute that talks about summary judgment, it is the same thing. You're to consider everything that could be introduced. And the only thing that's been introduced is an assertion that there's a difference in rates. That's the only thing. Well, sure, there's a difference in rates. No company has the same rate. No company has the same cost characteristic. Exactly the same. So when you do the cost study, things are going to come out differently for each company. So rates are going to be different for each company. So that proves nothing. There's nothing in anything that they have pled, and Judge King uses the words well pled, that would lead you to believe that they would be successful in any complaint. There's nothing. There's no doubt that they couldn't be successful. The mere fact that they're two different rates proves nothing, establishes nothing, raises no issue. Now, the fact that they haven't paid, that certainly calls into question the filed rate doctrine. Once you've established a filed rate, the customer is under a legal obligation to pay that rate, and AT&T didn't do that, and to allow them to get away with that seems to be unconscionable. They flouted your statutes, they flouted your findings, they've declared them to be practically inconsequential, and that they don't have to follow them. They can do whatever they darn well please because they are AT&T. And that's the attitude that comes across in their pleadings. That's the attitude that came across when we discussed this with them for months trying to get payment. So, I mean, if you want to engender that kind of conduct, if you want to encourage that kind of conduct, If you want to encourage complaints that just by someone saying, I think the rate's unfair, therefore, commission, you've got to go back and take a look again, without anything more. And again, the Schlosser case makes that very clear. You know, you have to have something, some kind, something that shows you're going to be kind of successful at this complaint, and there's nothing here. And the comfort you can take in dismissing this complaint is, number one, you've got a very experienced staff that reviews this these dockets and approves the cost studies after very thorough and detailed review. And you've got the fact that Prairie Wave is going to have to do it again next year. And so Prairie Wave just does not see any purpose in this complaint. The complaint should be dismissed. Prairie Wave does not see any reason why we should not have summary judgment on this. And the filed rate doctrine plays a part. I'm sorry, you cannot separate that under either dismissing the complaint or granting the motion for summary judgment. That's what the law is, that when you approve rates as fair and reasonable and are presumed fair and reasonable, and the customer is supposed to pay that rate. And can only charge that rate. And that's all we've done. It's followed the law. AT&T has not. And I guess that's what you really need to consider.
Thank you. I do have a couple questions, Mr. Houston. One, certainly in a situation like this, there may be some value with allowing discovery to go forward. This isn't your typical case where all the facts may be readily at hand or ascertainable, which sometimes may be the case. And at some point in time, then certainly if AT&T is unable to make some sort of offer or proof or affidavit going forward, certainly I would think that at that point in time it might be something the commission could look at and consider dismissing the case or granting summary judgment. But is there not some value to going forward? I mean, the challenges that they may have in this case, and I'm not going to put words in their mouth, but you're dealing with information that may be confidential or difficult to receive. And is there not some value in letting this go forward at least a little ways, seeing if they can come forward with some type of offer of proof at that point in time, and then dealing with your motions at that point in time?
Quite frankly, I see no value. As I said, we're going to file this again next year on this year's test period. They've had all kinds of time to make those kinds of requests under the umbrella of this docket. I've received no requests for any information from them. No discovery. They could have filed for discovery. They've done nothing. Now to suggest something to them and to give them, additional leeway, that's going to take us all the way into 2007. I mean, how difficult was it to get just this oral argument on the docket in August, and because of problems with the commission and the commission's docket going forward. When are we going? And then if we do a hearing, and then I get those rates approved. And by the way, AT&T is completely wrong about December 15th, the filing of their counterclaim, somehow stopping what rates they have to pay. That's not the filed rate doctrine. As Ms. Graff pointed out in her brief, that rates are prospective in nature, and the rates are the rates until they're changed. And so they need to pay our rates until they're changed. That's the way the filed rate doctrine works. They're prospective. We don't go back in any retroactive rate making and say somehow just because they filed a complaint. Now, those of you who are familiar with, and your staff is very familiar with the rate making process, what you used to and what you did, and why one of the companies came in today to reopen its docket from 2003 using a 2001 test year was to do away with rates subject to refund. Well, when you order our rates into effect, it was not subject to refund. Those rates are the rates until you change them. December 15th is no magic date. Now, we've agreed to allow them to pay something less than the protest amount because that was the only way we were going to get our money. Some money. It's the same thing we agreed to in Minnesota when they when they were ordered to pay us under the same complaint. I mean, you cannot let an inter-exchange carrier decide who it's going to pay when and where when you have a filed rate, not where you have a tariff, and you have laws that require that tariff. And we are required to file, and we are required to do all this, and then to make us jump through those hoops again. That seems to be patently unfair to have to go through this now at this late date when we're coming up on the 3 years and when there's been no protest from any other company, and they would not have filed. I mean, I guess I could have filed a complaint and just, you know, they wouldn't have complained about the rates because I didn't complain. They just would have not paid. You're rewarding that misconduct is what you're doing.
I haven't done anything yet. But.
Well, that's what you would do. That's what you would do. You would reward that misconduct.
Back to the issue of payment, and I don't know if you've been following the case or not, but there's been a case involving Western Wireless and some of the telephone cooperatives. And in that case, we have a situation where Western Wireless is claiming that they are entitled to payment or refund. Have you been following that situation at all?
No, I have not.
Okay. And I may see if there's any sort of analogy to this situation, to what's happened in that case. And I don't want to be making apples to oranges comparison, but, you know, I do think the commission is mindful that if something is owed, and it's not within the range of the dispute, that certainly, you know, we feel it should be paid. And, you know, if it's not paid, then you know, certainly the party in question is taking the chance that they'll be asked to pay interest and you know any other appropriate penalties. So I guess I'll ask Mr. Smith if is there any anything we can draw from that other case.
Well, again, without wanting to, in case it becomes an issue, it is an issue in another case, and the commission has decided in another case that interest is in fact payable on monetary damages in South Dakota. Period. And to the best of our, you know, that's a ruling we made in another case, and somebody can argue something else here. But there used to be a distinction in South Dakota between liquidated and unliquidated amounts and all that, and actually that's been abrogated at this point. The only things that our interest is not recoverable under South Dakota law are damages in the nature of punitive damages, and then a few other specific exceptions.
Thank you. Any other commissioner questions for Mr. Houston?
Or staff?
Go ahead. All right, excuse me, I should say.
Do you have any other questions?
I don't.
Chairman Starr.
And actually, Mr. Cook, we'll come back around to AT&T, and I do have a question for you.
Great, thank you.
I'm just going to see if we can maybe finish up here with Mr. Houston, and then we'll give you or your in-state counsel an opportunity to respond.
Great.
Do you want me to...
I thought Commissioner Johnson was
afraid. Spring into action?
I just always look thoughtful like that, okay. Mr. Smith.
Do you have questions for Mr. Houston?
With respect to your summary judgment motion, you know, the rule 15656 seems to say that this motion for summary judgment can be made with or without affidavit. I know that you did submit an affidavit. Do you have any thoughts? Am I wrong in that AT&T did not submit any kind of affidavit that would oppose your motion?
There's nothing other than the bare pleading.
Okay, and would it be your position that in the absence of an affidavit or some kind of offer of proof, is that relevant here?
I think it's relevant. I mean, they had the opportunity to supplement the record as part of the summary judgment process, and they chose not to do that. They relied solely on just the bare pleading, which just says that the Quest rate is different than the Prairie Wave rate. And if you read the Schlosser case, Judge Keene makes a distinction between facts and conclusions. And, yes, we're stuck with the facts, but we're not stuck with conclusions. The fact is, yeah, the rate's different. That's a fact. The conclusion is that it's unfair. That's not a fact. And that's the trier of fact doesn't have to accept it. The entity ruling on the motion doesn't have to accept that because it is a conclusion. It's not a fact. So the only fact we have in here of any relevance is the fact that the Quest rate is less than 6 cents and the Prairie Wave rate is less than 7 cents. That's it. Now, how that, you know, I think it's beyond a doubt that that doesn't prove anything. And I think under the statute, civil procedure, and under the Schlosser case, I think that decides the matter in Prairie Wave's favor.
Commissioners, do you have any other questions? Can you clarify for me, from your Prairie Wave standpoint, Mr. Heaston, what the, you know, I've read all of the briefs, et cetera, but, okay, what is the current status of payment now, I guess? Have they paid? What have they paid?
Well, Mr. Cook described that accurately. Mm-hmm. They paid nothing.
They paid nothing?
They paid nothing. They are in the process of paying, and we should see something by August 14th. There was one minor discrepancy, and I don't know what that was. I know we thought they had paid something. We had given them a credit, and they couldn't find it. I don't know if that was the discrepancy that she talks about, but whatever it was very minor. You know, they haven't paid anything. And we're about to get, I guess, a check somewhere in the vicinity of $130,000. I mean, the brief they filed where they said they were going to pay goes back a few months.
Is that payment, and is there a written agreement between the parties relative to that payment?
No, there is not.
Okay. Is there a, why do you think you're going, what's the basis? Is this just a rumor, or is it a gentleman's agreement, or where are we at?
We had, as Mr. Cook described, AT&T sent us a worksheet, a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet, where they said these were the amounts, and then we had to, do you agree with these amounts? And then we looked at them and sent them back, and I think we pretty much agreed with what they sent us. We're not disputing the number of minutes that they owe on. We're not disputing what the rate is that's applied to those minutes. We just we got a spreadsheet pretty much like we had sent them earlier back, showing the month, the number of minutes, and then the various rates, and we both verified the spreadsheet amounts, and now we're going to get a check that takes us up full payment, I assume, through December 15th, and then partial payments after December 15th based on their claim that somehow the filed rate doctrine stopped on December 15th with their claim.
And is there a, in terms of the post December 15th period, what's the basis for the rate that AT&T has agreed to pay?
The Quest rate.
So Quest that's rate. It. Okay, that's it's the difference.
Post December 15th, it's the Quest rate, as I understand it. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, to staff's knowledge, we have not seen the email conversations or the spreadsheets or the corrections to the spreadsheets that these guys are referring to.
I mean, you would agree, right, at the point when at least your complaint is partially satisfied and at the point when that payment's made?
It's partially satisfied for the amounts that they paid in full.
Okay. Other questions?
Not of Mr. Heaston. I do have a question of AT&T.
Right. Yeah, I'm just going to let him step down.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Van Camp's at the microphone and here in Pierre, and Mr. Cook, I assume you're still on the line are you in Colorado?
I am.
All right. The question I would have is sort of the flip question I asked for, or a flip side of what I asked for of Mr. Heaston, and that is, you know, going forward, do you intend to go through a discovery process, try to get some information out there where you're going to be able to, you know, hopefully, I guess from your perspective, perhaps present a little more factual evidence, and you know, just kind of open up the kind of similar line of questioning that I had for Mr. Heaston.
We would, Mr. Chairman, and in fact, we have already served discovery on Prairie Wave for South Dakota. We have gotten some partial answers, but notably, they refused to provide the cost study, which is really a key piece of evidence. And to demonstrate why that's key, and we filed testimony in a similar case in Minnesota, in which we used the cost study to demonstrate why the rates were unreasonable and unjust. And so Mr. Heaston's claim that we haven't served discovery is completely erroneous, and in fact we have, but we haven't been provided with all of the relevant information that we think we need to build a case. And just a couple of other comments on his argument. You know, we're not a normal summary judgment stance in this case, because there has been no discovery, there has been no opportunity to elicit additional evidence that's key to our case. And the cost study is considered confidential, so we have not been provided access to it except in a Minnesota case where we are prevented from using it except for purposes of that case, the standard protective order type situation. And so we are not in a position where we can present responsive evidence in response to a summary judgment motion that's posed at the front end of a case. And in addition to that, we filed a counterclaim that asserts our own claim concerning the ongoing validity of Prairie Wave's rates. And you know, Mr. Heaston would have you, the commission, determine the merits of that case at the front end by ruling on a summary judgment motion, which is completely inappropriate. The cases in South Dakota have been clear that pleading should not be dismissed merely because the court entertains doubts as to whether the pleader will prevail in the action, and this is the same standard that's applied in the summary judgment type of situation. There must be clear and convincing evidence that there's no claim for relief that could be stated on any set of facts in order for a motion to dismiss to be granted. And the corollary for the summary judgment motion is the prior fact must be clear that there are no issues of material fact in order to grant a summary judgment motion. And we would contend that based upon the claims that we have made in our counterclaim, and we should be given the opportunity to present the evidence that we presented in Minnesota and South Dakota, we believe that we can present a case as to why Prairie Wave's South Dakota rates are not just and reasonable and are not consistent with South Dakota law. Now, I would also note that Prairie Wave tariff in South Dakota permits AT&T to dispute a bill, which AT&T has done. It disputed the bill, as Mr. Heaston noted, back to 2005. And that is a common industry practice that when you dispute a bill, you withhold what you believe to be the inappropriate billing. In 2005, we couldn't figure out what Prairie Wave was billing. And there is a number of emails going back and forth between the parties concerning what the bill, how Prairie Wave was billing and what basis it was billing its rates at. The tariff also has a provision in it that provides for late payment charges in the event of a dispute and a withholding situation. So the tariff really covers the situation presented by Prairie Wave. AT&T filed a dispute. It disputed it in the rates informally up until the time that it filed its counterclaim. Now it's disputed them formally. So I think it's highly appropriate, frankly, for AT&T to pay what it believes is the reasonable amount, put the remainder in escrow, the disputed portion in escrow, to be dealt with once the commission resolves the legitimacy of Prairie Wave's rate. And I will say that there are, Prairie Wave is an outlier in terms of not following either the LECA rates or the Quest rates. Most CLECs in South Dakota are charging one or the other. So the fact that Prairie Wave has raised its rates above the Quest rates is indeed cause for alarm. And I will also note that the ILEC rate in the territory in which a CLEC serves is the appropriate rate that the FCC has determined in the CLEC access charge order to be the appropriate rate to be charged by CLECs for interstate services. So that's the basis for AT&T in setting the reasonable rate at the Quest rate. Long-winded answer, but...
I'd like to add, this is Bill Van Camp, Mr. Cook was not party to a scheduling conference that was held between AT&T, Prairie Wave staff, and the commission, and it's not reflected in the pleadings, but it was agreed at that point that we were not going to set a procedural schedule in this matter. Rather, we were going to hear this motion for summary judgment and dismissal as brought by Prairie Wave. It's only because of the congestion on the commission docket, I believe, that this has been pushed back as far as it was. The original idea, as I understand it, and Ms. Graft or Mr. Smith can concur in this, as can Mr. Heaston, that we were going to set a procedural schedule if this motion was not successful.
I think that does accurately reflect our discussions. I would caution that I don't know that a party ought to be penalized with respect to discovery at this point, although you can stand up here and criticize me if I'm wrong, Bill, but this thing has really been drug out, and I think everybody was thinking that, depending on how the motions came out, they wouldn't waste each other's money and time with too much. Can I just ask either Bill or Mr. Cook, I guess I can't say Bill, Mr. Van Camp, or Mr. Cook. Okay, let me ask you this. With respect to the switched access rates, I guess, would it be your position then that that a week after the commission approved the tariff as filed, that you could have come in here then and opened up a proceeding and challenged that rather than have proceeded through intervention and involvement in that case? And maybe I'm not presuming the answer. I'm just asking you if that's the position, is that at any time you could just collaterally challenge that through a complaint.
Thank you, Dukas. I think as a legal matter, you could assert a complaint. As a practical matter, whether that complaint would be heard by the commission may be a different story. But there's nothing in the law that would prevent that.
Okay, and in terms of...
And that certainly isn't the case here. So it's kind of a hypothetical that doesn't apply, but...
And I'm not sure, and you may have made a good point here, Mr. Cook, with respect to a motion to dismiss as opposed to a motion for summary judgment. Can I ask you, and maybe you're not prepared to answer this, but can you tell me, what, and maybe it's just that I don't remember the complaint, but other than the fact that Prairie Wave's rate is a little bit higher than Quest's rate, it's also dramatically lower than many of the other of the rural LECs, what is it that gives you some kind of reasonable basis to believe that the cost study that was filed and reviewed by staff, what is it that AT&T thinks is improper about the cost study and the rate? And maybe you can't answer that, but if you give us...
I don't think I can, because I think I'm foreclosed from providing details on the cost study by by virtue of the protective order in Minnesota.
And as South Dakota Council, we have not been able to see the cost study as filed, so.
Well, and I guess the other point is I'm assuming that the cost study used in Minnesota is the same cost study or methodology used in South Dakota, and I don't know that without having seen the South Dakota study.
Thank you. Mr. Heaston, do you have a couple last comments?
South Dakota is entirely different than Minnesota. You have rules, very specific rules, on how everything, how you account for the costs, how you allocate, how it goes into various accounts. It's based on the FCC's Part 3669 rules. You can ask Carlin or Greg. They work with these. Minnesota doesn't have that. Minnesota just says they have to be forward-looking costs. That's not what you have here in South Dakota. It's an entirely different regime, entirely different. So there's no way looking at a Minnesota FLEX study, forward-looking economic cost study that we filed in Minnesota, that you can come and see what's in South Dakota, and vice versa. There's no way that it's a whole different cost methodology. The cost methodology in South Dakota is historic, and Minnesota is forward-looking. And that's why you made the rules, was to give some structure and reasonableness to this, and so you could measure what the costs are, and so you could be assured that the rates that are filed are fair and reasonable, and that you require being filed under tariff. That's why you did it.
I have a question for Ms. Graff or Mr. Smith or Ms. Wiest. I mean, I'm trying to get some idea of what standards or rules of thumb I should be using. I mean, on one hand, I'm speaking with regard to Prairie Wave's motion to dismiss AT&T's counterclaim. On one hand, I wouldn't want to – I mean, I understand that a telecommunications company would have a right to protest a rate to want to open up a cost study and review that rate, and yet I don't quite know when that starts. I mean, your question about, you know, could they do it 1 week after the cost study's done, I thought was a good one, Mr. Smith. I mean, and I'm not saying that AT&T is doing that, but what is to preclude a company from essentially going on a fishing expedition after 6 months passes? I mean, is there a particular standard or rule of thumb I should be looking at here?
No, but staff would just point out, staff would just point out the opposite. You know, companies can also file for waivers of filing their switched access cost study. So what's precluding Prairie Wave from next year filing a waiver of filing their switched access cost study, and another 3 years goes out, and in 3 years they file another waiver and another waiver, and then again you're stuck with the same rate and no company can come in until those, you know, until those switched access cost studies are filed.
Am I right in presuming that interested parties could petition for intervention in those waiver requests?
I guess they could. I mean, but there's nothing in our statutes and our rules or anything prohibiting AT&T from doing what they're doing. There's nothing prohibiting them from filing their counterclaim. There's nothing prohibiting them from filing, a complaint. I guess Prairie Wave filed the complaint and AT&T filed the counterclaim.
So is there no standard by which the commission could ever, is it your contention there's no standard by which the commission could ever dismiss a counterclaim? I mean, a counterclaim similar to what AT&T has put forth? I mean, all they have to say is that they don't think the rate is right, and then regardless of what their filing says, that they would have an opportunity to do that?
I'm saying there's nothing precluding that, and based on the arguments raised by Prairie Wave being the filed rate doctrine and raised judicata, those should not be a bar for AT&T filing their counterclaim.
Did anyone else have any thoughts, guidance for me at least?
Well, I guess the one point I would make is that it would kind of be silly of a company to file a complaint a week after a rate case proceeding. I mean, in a complaint, the burden is on the complainant to proceed and to prove that the rate is unreasonable. It would be make much more sense for that company to have intervened in the underlying rate case when the burden is on the company to prove that their rates are reasonable. I mean, from a practical standpoint.
I think probably, I mean, I'm unaware of this, but other than maybe based on some kind of equitable or claim preclusion principles, I don't know that there's anything explicit in either our rules or any statute that would probably preclude filing it 15 days later, as I think Ms. DeCook. It depends on, you know, I mean, I think Mr. Heaston is reading our rule 2010-2707 as implying, right, implying that there is a three-year sort of term, I guess, for lack of a better term.
And everybody knows that. AT&T knows that.
It would you agree, though, that the rule, our dilemma, if the rule just said that, you know, it would be so much easier for us to rule that way, well, but it doesn't.
It's like the legislature. I mean, that's what you did. You legislated. You sometimes you just don't think of all the things that can pop up as time goes on.
But in this case, the rule specifically says, in addition to the three-year limit, that the commission may change or revise any rate or price in accordance with 49.31.12 and 49.31.12.4, which says that the commission may change rates as circumstances require. So to me, that suggests that the commission has authority within the three-year period to change rates if it deems appropriate.
Excuse me, Mr. Heaston. Can you tell us for what period of time this 100 and this disputed amount originally, $138,000 approximately, when did that begin to accrue?
In May of 2005 is when they stopped paying their bills.
Thank you.
We had the rate approved in December of 2004, so it went into effect right at the end of December. It wasn't until May of 2005 that I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, AT&T stopped paying.
So it was approximately 5 months, less than 5 months, or approximately 5 months later?
I think they paid for 4 months, and the fifth month they didn't pay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions, comments? Do we have a motion? Seeing none, I will make a motion. I move that the commission deny Prairie Way's motion to dismiss AT&T's counterclaim and that the commission deny Prairie Way's motion for summary judgment.
Second.
I respectfully dissent on both issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we are back to electricity.
Before you continue, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Heaston.
I would then like to get some idea how we're going to proceed in this docket. And I would like to get some idea from the commission as to what their attitude is on AT&T's payment going forward, whether they should be paying the full amount or whether they should be paying and holding some in escrow.
The second question I would direct to general counsel and see if he's comfortable even putting forth anything. It is very similar to some circumstances that we're dealing with in a pending case, and I'm going to exercise some care in responding to that.
I guess what I would hope is that we would go to the 14th date as you've discussed, and that they would make the payment and at least bring that up to currency. Again, but on this record, in terms of the commission ordering them to pay. I don't think we can make such an adjudication without a complete record, especially based on the rulings that the commission just made. But again, I would prevail just from a good faith and from a reasonableness standard that AT&T do what, as a good business a business person, it believes to be the right thing, and to get you at least paid up with undisputed amounts. But beyond that, I don't think the record is in a status here for us to order anybody to do
it. Can I ask that the commission then expedite the hearing on this? We get this on the docket as soon as we can.
Well, we've got, if you want to wait, we've got one more item, then we have another hearing. We could get you in this afternoon, perhaps.
Well, that's fine.
No, I guess, again, I'll look to General Counsel. I would like to add one thing to his statement, though, is that, you know, certainly with the other situation, you know, my instructions were along those lines that hopefully with what is not in dispute that should be paid, and certainly I think it's something we're looking at. I think it's within the realm of the commission's power to order interest and so on and so forth. So I think we all, if there is an undisputed amount and there's some reason why, and there's not any reason why it shouldn't be paid, certainly, you know, the commission would look at that, you know, look at the side not paying that in a not very favorable light going forward. Again, I defer to Mr. Smith as far as the legal standard.
Well, and I, you know, in terms of scheduling, I mean, again, it's an extremely difficult thing to do to establish a procedural schedule here. I mean, not that we can't do it, but I mean, the easier normal way to do it is to that we do that, you know, and if there's a problem, then bring it before the commission. But you know, I guess it depends, Bill. We're going to have a long rest of the day yet. But if that's, you know, if that's what you want to do and that's what the commission wants to do, fine. Otherwise, I mean, normally what we would do is establish that based on the available dates and set up a procedural schedule and get it done.
Now, are you having the pre-hearing conference on the 14th, or what is?
No. On this?
I'm sorry.
We really didn't. I don't believe.
Or
we
you're waiting until
set
you,
any
you know what the
dates? Did we set any dates beyond this at this point in time? No, I don't think so.
I don't know what the agenda's like. You know, I don't know what the scheduling's like, and so on and so forth. But I mean, Mr. Heaston, I mean, is it possible for sometime in the next few days for the parties to get together and compare schedules and try to come up with something? Certainly we can wait until after we're done with our other business and come back to it, but normally that does not work well, you know, for all the obvious reasons that people don't have schedules before them and so on and so forth. So, I mean, is it possible to try to get something hammered out that's mutually acceptable, and then if you're unable to do it or if you're not happy with what the resolution is, you know, file something before the next commission meeting and we can intervene? But I think it does normally work better if the parties, the attorneys, can sit down after the fact versus us trying to pick dates that may or may not work, even for room availability and things like that.
Well, all I want to convey to the commission is the sense, you know, this is dragged out, how long it's dragged out,
right.
The fact that Prairie Wave has been out a lot of money, maybe we're going to get paid, we need to get this matter resolved.
I agree with that, and I, on behalf of myself, to the extent I've been responsible, and I'm not solely, but you know, my apologies for how long it's taken. But we just have had an extremely well. You can see what it's like around here. I mean, gosh, and we've had a very tough time finding dates. Hopefully we've had some things go away when we get out about a month or a month and a half, and hopefully we can get things on a faster track than they've been for the last 7-8 months, because I will agree we've really hit a logjam. I'm going to say I'm available all day tomorrow. You know, if the parties can be on the phone or here at any time tomorrow or when we're done today, let's go downstairs and get this done.
Well, let me ask this question, and you all may have answered this. I had a sidebar conversation, so I apologize. But when Mr. Heaston, when you talk about expediting, you know, setting a hearing date soon, what does that mean to you? I mean, do you want this heard in, you know, October 15th, come hell or high water? I mean, give me an idea of what you mean.
that's about the time frame would be sometime in the next 60 mm-hmm. days.
And I think that's doable.
Discovery and schedule and so on.
I think that's probably doable, but again, I have to defer ultimately to the commissioners who have to agree to dates that they can all be here.
Yeah, I just want to come
in. Just a comment on that, mm-hmm. since we haven't received all of the relevant discovery, and we may need to do additional discovery based on what we get. 60 days from our perspective to go to hearing is not doable.
Well, what about the idea of compressed discovery? I mean, we have been at this for quite a long time. Is that
well, achievable? We haven't been at the real litigation. We've been at the dispute over the motions. But
okay.
We will accommodate discovery as we can and try to expedite this if there's a way to expedite on the commission schedule and based on our schedule. But I think it's unfair to us as the litigant who has done discovery but not been provided with answers because of the pending motions to then limit our ability to conduct discovery, further discovery. I think that's not fair to us. But I think, we will accommodate the desire to expedite this as best we can while protecting our rights to do discovery.
I think the only workable way to deal with this is for the attorneys involved to get together either later today or, Bill, you were shaking your head about tomorrow. Is Ms. DeCook, could she stand in your stead? Rebecca, are you available tomorrow?
I'm sorry. Mr. Van Camp was shaking his head, or Mr. Easton?
Oh, I'm sorry, gosh. Mr. Van Camp was shaking his head, but you are also counsel, and...
I could participate by phone in a scheduling conference.
Okay, what time works? We're going to run out of phone here in 3 minutes.
Hey, staff's a part of this, too.
I realize that, but you're leaving here in a couple of days.
Exactly. So somebody else is going to be taking this case over who has never seen it before.
I've got that, but somebody can be there tomorrow if we need to.
Not me after 1 o'clock.
Fair enough. What do you think?
I'm available until 3.
Until 3?
Until 3.
I'm available all morning, too.
Okay, why don't we say 10 o'clock in the morning?
10 o'clock your time?
Yes.
Okay.
Our time. Thank you. And now there's an announcement here about a bridge.
Well, excuse me. First thing, is there anyone on the phone line who is waiting for the FEM matter? And if not, the bridge shouldn't matter. Is that correct? Is there anyone else?
No, it doesn't matter if there's no one.
Okay. And that's all I was going to check. I think the people are all here in Pierre, aren't they? Do any of you have clients or people that need to be in on the line? Yeah, that's fine.
Are you on the internet?
Yes.
I think our people are listening on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, this Carl is coming off the record. But we just needed to get it done because if not, John needs to give people dial-in numbers. So it is important to let that go forward.
You are the only person.